that would imply to the Indonesians that their approach to airplanes might generate a miracle. Let's put it that way.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, the success of many of the economies in East Asia in achieving rapid and equitable growth, often in the context of activist public policies, raises complex questions about the relationship between government, the private sector, and the market. Well, that's from the first paragraph of the foreword of The East Asian Miracle, a 1993 report from the World Bank. It was published at a time when industrial policy was not often taken seriously, either inside or outside the bank. But it nevertheless analysed the remarkable post-war development of countries that had leaned heavily on those types of policies. Now, Ansi Birdsall, now President Emerita of the Centre for Global Development, was involved in the creation of that report and has just published an article that revisits its origin, what it did and didn't say, its influence at the time, and its relevance today. So, Nancy, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Nancy, take us back to the early 1990s. The extraordinary growth that we saw in Japan and Korea and neighboring countries, was that already being branded, thought of as a miracle, a growth miracle?
It's a good question, Tim, but I think the answer is no. You know, insiders surely knew, people at the World Bank and the IMF, but, and I think in general, readers of the Financial Times and Wall Street Journal had some sense that Japan was doing very well indeed post-war. But beyond Japan, I'm not so sure.
You were at the World Bank at this time. The policy consensus within the World Bank about how you achieve successful, sustained growth, what was it during that period?
Well, very much about the fundamentals. I think it's useful to think back, for those of us who are old enough, to that time. We're talking about a few years after the Soviet Union had fallen apart. The World Trade Organization was pulling together as an organization. Bill Clinton had been president and had pushed through what we used to call NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It was the neoliberal era for sure. It was the time when Frank Fukuyama was calling it the end of history. The Washington Consensus had emerged as a little bit the Bible, or at least seen that way outside Washington, especially as the Bible of the U.S. approach to free market neoliberal policies.
Did those neoliberal policies capture, in the broadest terms, what had been happening in these East Asian economies?
Yes and no. Yes, because if you think about the fundamentals at the center of the fundamentals was don't get in trouble with your macroeconomic policies. Don't have a big fiscal deficit. Don't spend more than as a government than you have collect. So yes, they were seen in that way, certainly inside the IMF and the World Bank, as successful countries following along on the fundamentals. At the same time, the fact that they had somewhat different policies than were defined and talked about extensively inside the World Bank means that they didn't quite fit in.
I remember that time as well, and I remember in studying economics, that set of policies that we now call neoliberal policies, it was really sort of the only thing that you learnt about. Was there a policy debate within the World Bank and the IMF about this as well, or was the issue considered settled at the time?
I would say on the question of industrial policy, if you're referring to that, there was no policy debate. Indeed, I think that's why no discussion and not a lot of understanding at the level of, say, people doing research, let alone those who are doing day-to-day operations and interacting with countries on policies. So I think that's why the Japanese were interested in having a study done inside the bank, because they felt that the success of the East Asian countries around them and their own success was not being fully understood. It was a very smart way to expose more people inside the bank to the realities of what was happening in East Asia.
So in 1993, this report is that the Japanese government really wanted this report published. How were you involved with it at the time?
Interesting question. Not that much, actually. So I think what's useful to understand is that it's not exactly that they wanted it published. What the Japanese did is they said to the bank, we will finance a study of what is happening and has been happening in our own economy and in the economies around us. And it was a very clever way to expose what the Japanese understood would be sensible, smart people inside the bank to the specifics of what they had done and how they had done it, what was behind their rapid growth. And a lot of people knew generally that there was METI inside the World Bank, inside Japan, the Ministry of Trade and Industry, that had pushed for heavy industry and so on, and knew about Korea trying to do some of the same thing. But it was very, no one inside the bank had really studied it, had talked about it, exposed it. We have to go back to we were just talking about it. It was the era of neoliberal post-Soviet Union breakup. A lot going on anyway about all these new members coming into the World Bank and the IMF and so on. So the Japanese were smart. They wanted smart people inside the bank to start to get exposed to their success and look more carefully at the success of Korea and Taiwan, Hong Kong, etc.
So really we have here the idea that, first of all, to look in more detail about those policies, I suppose also to dispel any kind of thinking that somehow these economies had got lucky in some way or had catch-up growth or anything like that. Is that the case?
I think that's right, although it's interesting. It's a good question. It's not as though there was... Now, you're just hearing it from me, you know, and I wasn't even the typical World Bank country economist. I'd been working in the research department or this policy and research sort of work, and mostly on health and education in the developing world. So, you know, I don't think, however, I was unusual in the sense that even people working on South Asia and East Asia, Latin America, I was certainly familiar with Latin America in particular, spent a lot of time in Brazil, and it just didn't come up. You know, this question that this issue we now call industrial policy really didn't come up that much. Now, maybe it did for country economists who are deeply working on a country like Korea. There certainly were such people that I came to know in the process of working on this miracle report, but it just wasn't a big issue.
Now, you can still find the report on the World Bank website. It's buried a little bit, but it's possible to find. I was looking at it. It puts a lot of emphasis on what you already mentioned, this question of fundamentals. When we're talking about fundamentals specifically, what is it referring to?
Right. So I'd say the most important thing it's referring to is macroeconomic stability, which in regular language would be the government should not be spending more than it's collecting. But it also means fairly open and free trade, not blocking or protecting domestic industries, not subsidizing one sector or another, putting government resources into social programs so that people get education and some health care. Open trade, right. That's the basic idea.
In your article on this, you mentioned the prevalence at the time of shared prosperity policies within these East Asian economies, things that we now think of as quite politically brave and certainly very effective, things like the land reform that went on. Was the bank thinking about these sort of policies, the idea of shared prosperity at that time?
No, it's a new, even the expression shared prosperity didn't come for another 10 or 20 years. There were certainly people in the bank, in particular, a couple of research economists who were interested in land reform, which is was very fundamental to the result of shared prosperity, was the reality of land reform in several countries post-war in East Asia, which, by the way, the U.S. military supported, and that was important. But there wasn't the same sense of getting children educated and providing health care, or doing what was done in Hong Kong in the miracle period, making sure there was adequate housing for everybody. That wasn't seen. The expression didn't exist. It was out there, you know, the concept of you want everybody to share in growth. But I think the definition of shared prosperity, the formalization of the idea, it took another 20 years before before the World Bank started doing an annual report on shared prosperity. So there we are. It was not tops on the agenda.
One of the reasons we're thinking about this is because industrial policy is back on the agenda. And as you say, it wasn't really discussed at the time and wasn't really considered as policy. The clearest manifestation, looking at it from a distance, that we can see of that industrial policy was the idea that these economies grew through export-led growth in manufacturing and the direction of the growth of that manufacturing. Well, the government played a huge part in it. In the report at the time, was this covered in detail? Was this covered to the extent that we consider it was important now?
Yeah, I mean, the report put a very strong emphasis on what you just said, that there was support to encourage exports of manufactured goods. It wasn't defined as industrial policy at the time. And I'd say even in the report, the East Asia Miracle Report, industrial policy was defined more along the lines of what the Japanese had done and the Koreans were doing, that is, support for a specific industry or set of industries. Shipbuilding, steel, you know, heavy and chemical type industries. So what the report did was say the East Asian economies as a group, particularly in the Northeast economies, did this thing, which was to push and encourage and have some policies that encouraged and supported export-led growth by manufacturing entities. Mm-hmm. And they did that in a couple of ways. So that was, you know, I wasn't that involved in the details, but looking back and reading the report in order to prepare the article that we're talking about, that's when I really saw the very strong focus on this export-led manufacturing growth and some good understanding of how in the Northeast, in particular, the Northeast economies, this approach succeeded. But the definition of industrial policy in the report is not exactly defined along those. That's not considered. Industrial policy was considered to be and defined as the government supporting a particular sector that would then, if industrial policy was succeeding, you would find evidence that that sector had been more productive in some sense than other sectors. And in the report, it's pointed out that no, textiles were the most highly productive sector in some of these countries, not the things that we would think of as having been pushed under something called industrial policy. At the same time, the report was very clear that support for pushing manufactured exports, exactly how it was done and how it worked and how it was successful.
So explain to me this tension in the report between what are the prevailing policies at the time and what seemed to be going on. How did the report manage to thread the needle here? What sort of conclusions did it come to about what was working? Because we're not talking about one case. We're talking about a group of countries over a sustained time.
I think the report was very clear that certain policies were undertaken to encourage manufactured exports. And those policies are not viewed as industrial policy, but they are focused on and certainly can be interpreted ex post as an approach that you could call industrial policy in a way that worked. I mean, they did certain things. They made it you could get credit more easily if you could show that you had orders for exports. You could then get some subsidized credit. You might get a little bit of protection from imports competition, but the main focus was, I'd say, the key was this performance-based credit subsidies. And by performance-based simply meant you had to show that you had orders to send stuff overseas that you were producing. So that was, in a way, I think my colleagues in the department at the time who were managing and thinking through this report did a very brilliant job of showing the active engagement of government in the private sector, in the private market, but they didn't exactly call it industrial policy.
Nancy, I've been involved in the preparation of a couple of World Bank reports, nowhere near the level and to the extent that you have, but even I could see that there are many eyes upon a report, both in its compilation and its publication, inside the bank and outside. And a lot of people have an opinion. What were the opinions on this report when it was published, inside the bank and outside the bank?
I would say very positive. I was head of the department which was doing the report. Okay, so I interacted somewhat with the person who was in charge of the report and with some of the consultants and so on. And I participated indirectly working on labor market issues and the social sectors. I think people saw the report as good, excellent, good work. They didn't see it as particularly controversial. There was a little bit of controversy, I suppose, in the process of getting the report finally approved at the board level, in particular because in Indonesia, for example, the government was pushing for, wanted to have and did do this to some extent, subsidizing. They wanted to have airplanes, right? They wanted to develop an airplane industry. And the regional department, which was doing lending with Indonesia, was resisting that because they said this is industrial policy and it's not the fundamentals. it's risky. And so that department in East, that covered East Asian economies, was nervous about how this issue would be addressed in the report and resisted to some extent anything that seemed to be saying that would imply to the Indonesians that their approach to airplanes might generate a miracle. Let's put it that way. And, you know, they didn't want this report to undermine their dialogue with the government of Indonesia on the risks, the high risks of the way they were proposing to proceed on subsidizing the airplane sector.
The consensus now on the Washington consensus and that basket of neoliberal policies is maybe that they were perhaps a little bit too neoliberal and ignored a little bit too much of what was actually happening. Is there a sense that this report, if people had paid closer attention to what had actually happened in these East Asian countries, could have influenced policy in a more positive way in other countries during the 1990s and beyond, that it was a missed opportunity? Is that reading too much into it?
I think it's interesting. It's reading a little bit too much into it. I think that it is too bad that once the report was done, which was a response to the request of the Japanese, within the next 3, 4, 5 years, there wasn't, from inside the bank, a major effort to extract lessons for other developing countries. I mean, it's there if you read the report, but it wasn't, there could have been more done to make sure that whatever those lessons are would infect in a positive way the operational approach in countries in other regions. What did they do in East Asia, and could that be done? I mean, I don't want to go too far in saying that. Certainly, the idea of having export zones did emerge in that period and still exists in the bank, that you have a certain part of the country, you know, that, or where things are a little bit easier for those who are manufacturing in those zones. They have certain privileges, certain interactions with government that make it easier for them to proceed. And but aside from the export zones, I don't think there was much follow-up on some of the more interesting, complicated approaches that the East Asians took. I mean, in particular, this issue of the dialogue, setting up a formal dialogue between the private sector, business people, and government people in the search for areas where there could be positive steps taken.
So can we think about lessons for today? A lot of policymakers are quite comfortable talking about industrial policy and their use of it. If we were to go back to that report and look at it again, are there things that we can learn that could positively influence policy today?
Yes, I think definitely. I think much more help could go to countries to set up this interaction between private business people and government on where, you know, where the government could provide some support for growth. That's not an easy thing to do it well. So more attention could go to the prerequisites for that kind of dialogue to succeed, which include that you have to have bureaucrats who feel comfortable, who are not subject to pressures of corruption or being bought off, that have, you know, standing as serious people inside their government, that have good salaries, that are in positions that are competitive, all those sort of very straightforward, simple things that I think most governments in developing countries have made tons of progress on in the last 30, 40 years. But the system for the interaction, how that exactly works, and I'm not that familiar with it, but, you know, who's involved and how does that work and to what extent do those who interact with the business sector need access at the highest level? That's one of the things that people say now. There's been some work on how this might work in Latin America, and the emphasis is you might need to be able to go all the way to the president if you're one of the bureaucrats in this interactive process. So that, I think, has been tried a little bit in. There's a report of the Inter-American Development Bank that focuses on some of those issues, how to make that work and where it's worked. And certainly the bank has traditionally focused on having education, sufficient salaries for bureaucrats. Some of these things seem obvious anyway, but I don't think there would be much harm in a more detailed look. Oh, the other thing that I would say, is the Japanese, how did they subsidize credit for exporters who were performing? Partly it was because they had savings rates, you know, repression in a way, right? So they had postal savings system. So people who saved got a good return, but they also didn't get as much return as they would if it was completely the private market, right? And that helped finance government subsidies to the successful exporters. So there's more complications there, right? And lessons to be learned. But I think this postal savings issue is a great one for many developing countries, something to be developed.
Yeah, it's your article about this is fascinating. Looking back at the report again, it's fascinating as well. I would recommend that everyone reads both of them. We'll put links to both of them in the show notes as well. But Nancy, thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's a pleasure.
The article is called The World Bank's East Asian Miracle, Too Much a Product of Its Time. And the author, Nancy Birdsall, of course. It is published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, Volume 39, Number 4. That's a 2025 publication. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where there are also articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you are hearing and seeing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review as well. It only takes a couple of clicks.